Come back. So let's. Well, we're going to focus like this. Just to get a context of what we're doing right now. We are following through Sefer Shmuel Beis, and in Shmuel Beis, we're covering. This section is called "Making of a Monarch." We're moving from David HaMelech in Perek Hei to Perek Yud. All we did last time is just to each piece sits independently. Last time we focused on how David HaMelech's first move was to conquer Yerushalayim. So you want to understand why Jerusalem is the capital of Israel? Well, David HaMelech thought so. That was the first thing he did as a king. So just to set the historical record straight, that was what we focused on last time. We're going to focus on three actions that David HaMelech actually does in his life now. And they are the next steps. So if you can imagine to yourself, what would you be doing if you were this new fledgling king, this new person who is who's joining the ranks, is trying to now unify a nation which up till now has never really been unified until the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, perhaps Yehoshua. What would you be doing? So after conquering Yerushalayim, this is our next step that we're seeing. So the first thing is an interesting thing is actually he is not the actor, he's really the object, he's the recipient. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the actual Pesukim for a second and look at each little subsection and think about it holistically. We're going to look at, this is in Perek Hei, Pasuk Yud Aleph to Yud Beis. This is a very small section. We learn about an interesting episode that occurs when David HaMelech takes control. So if you're in your folders, there's a Pesukim packet, right? With all the Pesukim, we're in Perek Hei on this. And here's how it goes. Vayishlach Hiram Melech Tzor Malachim El David Vatzei Razim V'Chor Shei Eitz V'Chor Shei Even Kir V'Yivnu Bais LeDavid. So upon David HaMelech becoming a king, he receives a gift from this individual called Hiram, who's the king of Tzor, up Tyre, up the coast in the Lebanon area, and he sends him wood, he sends him all kinds of gifts, and builds David a house, a palace. David then knew that he was the king over all Israel, and that his kingship has been established for him and all of Israel. Interesting episode over here. Who is Hiram? Let's start starting from the beginning. For even more basic question: is Hiram Jewish? Is Hiram Jewish? And the answer is no. He's not. He's a neighboring king. He is in the area of where we call today South Lebanon, right? So he is in the southern Lebanon region, and he is an ally at this point in time with David, and recognizing that David HaMelech has risen to power, is paying him homage. There's an interesting history, actually, in this, just to take a look. What I did was, for those who have the have the sources, if you don't have, there's a few extras just going around right over here. This is called Unit 3.2, and okay, great. There's a copy here. If you take a look at source 19, this is Josephus again. We looked at Josephus a little bit last time. Just saw the historical background. Here's what he describes. We're going to meet Hiram a number of times in Tanakh, but he gives a little bit of the historical background. He says, "For Hiram, the king of Tyre, was a friend of Solomon, our king, and had such friendship transmitted down to him from the forefathers. He thereupon was ambitious to contribute to the splendor of the edifice of Solomon," which is obviously referring to the Beis HaMikdash. So Hiram later on is going to contribute to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. He made him a present of 120 talents of gold. He also cut down the most excellent timber out of that mountain, which is called Libanos. What does that sound like? Lebanon, which is the area, right? You know, when we talk about the cedars of Lebanon, Arzei Levanon is because in that area they have their own cedar. If you notice, actually, with the flag of Lebanon, if anybody takes a look at it, not the flag of Hezbollah, but which is yellow, but the flag of Lebanon is actually, in the center of it, is a green tree. That's because the cedars of Lebanon, that's one of the natural resources. So he sent the wood down south to Israel to build the Beis HaMikdash, and sent it to him for adorning to its roof. Solomon also not only made him many other presents by way of requital, but gave him a country in the Galilee also, and was called Chabulon. So that means to say that he actually gave him a subsection of the Galilee. So you can imagine, this is so interesting. We're seeing over here an alliance developing between two kingdoms, the kingdom of Yisrael and the kingdom of the Tyre, which is going to be, we'll call it precursors to the Phoenician Carthage, which is going to happen later on. But there was another passion. a philosophic inclination of theirs, which cemented the friendship that was betwixt them. The language we're reading is 2,000 years old, which is why we're getting this language translated. For they sent mutual problems to one another with a desire to have them unriddled by each other, wherein Solomon was superior to Hiram, as he was wiser than he in other respects. So, and he talks about how there's a recorded letters in the annals of Tyre of the letters that Shlomo sent to Hiram. And we know in Tanakh, if we read Melachim Beis, or sorry, Melachim Aleph, we're going to see a number of the letters that Hiram, the questions that Hiram sends to him. It's interesting because this is just helpful in understanding this. The partnership, the alliance between Hiram and Shlomo, and this starting with David HaMelech right now, Shlomo's father, of course, is something which is going to create a great trade alliance. That means to say both the countries are going to be extremely rich because they essentially control the Fertile Crescent. They control the passage of all goods through the Middle East, and together they're going to marshal a great amount of power. Fascinating. Now, to appreciate that, now let's come to that back to our original Pasuk. When David HaMelech receives this great homage paid by Hiram, what does the Tanakh tell us about David's realization in Pasuk Yud Beis? It tells us, "Vayeda David ke chinoi Hashem al Melech al Yisrael." Then David knew that he became a king on Israel. Isn't that interesting? Something about this gift gave David the knowledge that he'd become king. Why so? In which way does this show David HaMelech that he's a king more than anything else? Conquest of Yerushalayim, the Aron, other things that are going to happen. Why do you think this is so significant to David?
Because it's obvious to see Hashem in this.
It's obvious to see Hashem in which aspect of it?
The fact that people that are not our friends are giving him things.
Right, so it's interesting. Like, this is one of the interesting questions that we can ask in general. You know, the Torah goes to such length to talk about Avraham Avinu's material success. Right? Meaning, mm-hmm. the Torah goes on to describe that Avraham Avinu was wealthy, and he had flocks, and he had cattle, and success, one thing after the next. And you have to ask yourself, you know, the Torah is pretty sparing in words, but it goes to great lengths also to describe power, beauty of the Avos and Imahos. It's interesting. The Torah goes to such levels. And you have to appreciate this, because, you know, imagine, you know, Avraham Avinu is sort of like, you know, in the age that he's living, everybody practices polytheism. There's all these forces. Avraham Avinu gets up there and says, you know, there's only one God. You know, and he gets up on his soapbox in Times Square and says, hear ye, there's only one God. So what do? You say, you make sure that your kids don't have any play dates at his house on Shabbos. Like, you know, you say, just stay away from that one. He's not very, you know, we've got to be a little careful about what goes on in Abraham's house. Or he dropped off the edge. Because, meaning, Avraham Avinu was really the anomaly. He was going against the tide of everybody else, whatever else was believing. But the thing that made him different to an average, you know, individual holding a cardboard sign at Times Square talking about the end is nigh, is that Avraham Avinu was immensely successful. That means the Torah goes to tell us that, you know, it's funny when you have somebody who's, you know, one of these doomsday prophets or, you know, these anomalies in society, we sort of sometimes, unfortunately, sometimes we sort of tune them out and we say, you know, maybe they don't know what's going on. But when something is working very, very much for them, and they seem to be this mega, you know, billionaire, then you say, well, you know, what they say there must be something to it, right? Because you know, how did they end up becoming so successful? The Torah emphasizes this is actually what's called a midah of Netzach of in Avraham Avinu. It's an aspect. It's not his full midah, but there's an aspect of Avraham Avinu's success being something which everybody is able to perceive. David HaMelech is experiencing that in a similar way right now, where David HaMelech is this small fledgling nation been under the pressure of Philistines for years and years and years. When other nations start leaning in and saying, you know what, you're worth investing in, that's a sign that David HaMelech takes for himself that there's something special is going on. That's an interesting thing to think about. It's not that we necessarily measure ourselves on the Nobel Prize, you know, notches on our belts necessarily. But it is something which says that there's something, there's some sort of level of success which is being recognized here. That's what that's what Rashi actually says. Rashi says, if you take a look in the actual notes over here in source 17, this is the new packet for today. Source 17, Rashi says, "Vayeda David bir oisoi kol ma'asov matzlichim," when he saw that all his actions were successful, "V'umalche hagoyim sholchim lo mincha," and the rest of the nations are sending him homage. To be clear, just to make sure that this is clear, last week we learned a little bit about how Avimelech, who was the king of the Philistines, also wanted to, you know, cozy up with Avraham Avinu when Avraham Avinu was successful. And Avram was mistaken in dealing with him. But that was because what Avimelech asked from Avram was a bilateral accord. He asked Avram to make a concession to him. Hiram is not asking for any concessions right now. Later, we're going to see there's a great trade alliance later on. There's going to be good border tariffs, right? No walls. It's going to be a good thing for both nations. But there's no signature here of Shlomo or David HaMelech or later on Shlomo that is conceding something to them. So just to worthwhile thinking about interaction of Israel and the neighbors. Okay, so this is the first thing that happens. This one, David HaMelech is actually somewhat passive to. He's just recognizing this happening to him as it's happening. But now, David HaMelech now does actually a few active things. This is after Hiram's gift. Let's move a little on into the Pesukim themselves. We're going to now focus on... oh, by the way, I did include in the notes, just, it is fascinating today, there is a tomb which is called Kabar Hiram. Take a look on page 9, the very top right. That is actually, as you can see, that's actually the British who are there. This is an old picture of Kabar Hiram. What does Kabar mean? Or Kaber?
Grave.
Means a grave. Like, you know, in Arabic, Kabar is similar to the word in Hebrew, which is Kever, right? Kabar Hiram is there, and it's hard to see because it's very light in the map, in the Google Maps, but it's actually very close to the town Kana, which is in South Lebanon, right? So when Israel was occupying and protecting themselves by having bases in South Lebanon, this is what we're seeing is happening over here. So just interestingly enough, this is actually somewhere you can actually go and visit if you weren't Jewish, because you can't really get into Lebanon right now safely. Okay, let's go a little further. Let's go a little further. Sorry about the timing. Always good. So here we go. So now the next section is what David HaMelech, it discusses David HaMelech's situation at home. So let's move from Pesukim to Yud Gimel to Tesvav. It's the next natural section. So David HaMelech marries additional wives and Pilagshim, which is this, so we'll call it a different type of marriage. It's got different restrictions and responsibilities. Right? So these are the names of his children he has in Yerushalayim. Of those names, most of them we don't hear so much about except for Shlomo. Right, so we're going to hear a lot about Shlomo. But it's interesting that a lot of the other children don't make it into mainstream Tanakh. We're not going to see so much about them later on. We're told that he has all these children and he gets married and has more wives. You know he has two wives already. But he has more. Why do we hear about this now, man? Why is this necessary to describe his family situation right now? At this point in time, why is this a necessary? Remember, the Tanakh is setting up over here David HaMelech's first steps as he becomes king. So, why is this a necessary first step?
Foreshadowing for their heirs.
Okay, so it might be an aspect of heirs. Why? Because progeny. Why? But why is that important? Why specifically did the Tanakh need to tell us? Yeah, setting up his legacy. Is that what you were saying, Debbie?
Right?
Who's going to be the next king? Continuity. So listen to what the Chumash Tanakh says. It's such a fascinating thing. You know, there's a number of things that Tanakh describe, which doesn't necessarily prescribe. Meaning to say, Tanakh tells us about a number of things, but it doesn't always tell you have to do these things. It just happens to be a practice of the time. Mm-hmm. Here is an interesting example. The Chumash Tanakh, which is the Chida, Rav Azulai on Tanakh, has a pirush called the Chumash Tanakh. He says in his explanation, if you're in the Mefarshim packets, this is on source 20, middle of page 9. He says, we're moving from texts to Mefarshim and backwards and forwards. So he says, Vayikach od pilagshim, lefi shehedyat asur bepilegesh. He says this notion of what a pilegesh was, it seems to be a pilegesh is a type of union, a type of marriage with different responsibilities than ksuba. Right? So there's different responsibilities. So his argument in general is that a regular individual is not allowed to marry a pilegesh. That type of relationship is not allowed. K'moshe kosev HaRav Mamzal, v'ato shehu melech gadol v'yoda ki heichino Hashem lemelech lo kach pilagshim v'lo zeh hikdim pilagshim shehu hachirosh. So he's saying that only a king, the Rambam says that pre-Matan Torah, there was a lot more flexibility in relationships, and certainly in the non-Abrahamic world. But after Matan Torah, then this notion called the Pilegesh was not actually allowed except for a king. So this is a demonstration what David HaMelech is doing, is in a certain sense, he's marrying the Pilag Shim, is an example of his status as a king as opposed to a regular individual. Yeah, Autumn.
Didn't we learn, though, in another Navi?
Yes, about Pilagesh. So it's interesting. So the Rambam has to contend with this. Not everybody agrees with this Rambam, mm-hmm. but the Rambam is very specific about this, and it could be that people just simply were not. We're not in line.
It's also but they had kings.
Yeah, well, but still, So it's a whole discussion. Actually, the Mefarshim on the Rambam talk about this. You know, because once the Torah was given, essentially all relationships have to be relationships of responsibility, and so the exception is the king. And it's an interesting question as to why a king may be different. But nonetheless, what the Chida is saying over here is that this is not just an arbitrary fact about David HaMelech, you know. On the home front, this happens to be an aspect of what David HaMelech was doing in terms of establishing his presence, so to speak, meaning that we're hearing about on the public frontier, on the private frontier as well, while David HaMelech's uniqueness. And now we have an interesting episode that occurs. Here, this to me is a very fascinating next step that happens. So everything seems to be just fine. Everybody seems to be all in line with things, but not the neighbors down in the south. So let's take a look at this next section. This next section in the Pesukim runs from Pasuk Yud Zayin till the end of the Perek, which is Chof Hay. So here's what we hear. The Philistines react. Vayishmu plishtim ki moshchu es David lemelech al Yisrael. Vayalu al kol haplishtim levakesh es David vayishma David vayered el hamitzudah. So David HaMelech, and the Philistines here is being appointed a king. They all come to seek out David HaMelech, and he goes to the mitzudah. Well, the mitzvah is his house, the fortifications of the area of Yerushalayim. The plishtim bo vaynotshu be'emek Rephaim, and the plishtim come and they settle in the valley of Rephaim, Emek Rephaim. That's good neighborhood in Yerushalayim today. Vayishal David. By the way, that's the beauty when you walk in the land of Israel, you're literally walking in the places of Tanakh. You know, vayishal David ba'Hashem lemor. And by the way, do you know something? That's not so far from the old city. Right, so just think about if that is the specific area of Emek Rephaim, right? You know, so we can imagine, you know, how close this is to the sort of area of where Migdal David is or Ir David is. Vayishal David ba Hashem lemor ha'aleh la plishtim at ha'sit name biyadi. So David HaMelech quickly consults with Hashem through the Urim V'Tumim, right? So he's using the Urim V'Tumim to say, what should I do? Vayomer Hashem el David, aleh ki nasan etenes ha'plishtim biyadecha, I will give them in your hands. Vayovod David beval paratzim. So David goes to this area called Baal Pratzim. He attacks them and he smites them. My Hashem has split my enemies like Hashem splits through water. Interesting metaphor. He calls that place the area of splitting. So and they left their avodah zaros, their deities, and David HaMelech took them. Interesting. This is interesting on a number of levels here. First of all, it's interesting to hear David HaMelech's response, his emotional response to a action, because usually where do you hear David HaMelech's emotional responses? Not in Sefer Shmuel, but in Sefer Tehillim. So usually we hear David HaMelech's sort of responses to things there. It's interesting we have a sort of a murmur, although it says, Hashem gives my enemies in my hand. You can hear various Tehillim sound just like this. But David says, "My Hashem, you know, gives me my enemies." It's interesting that there's a convergence of story and response to story here. But these are persistent Philistines. And they come again to Emek Rephaim. So he asks Hashem again. You can see the humility of David. David HaMelech does not just jump into battle, especially seeing he's already got the license to attack them. It's the same place. He still asks Hashem. And Hashem says, nope, not this time. This time go around the back. He says, V'yivihi k'shamacho has called Sa'adah b'roshah b'choyim. When you hear the marching, then oz techeratz ki oz yatzolof Hashem l'fonecha la'kos b'machane plishtim. When you hear the sound, I'll let you know the moment. You go and attack them from the rear. And he gives them a decimating, a strike, which really, 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 really pulls them down. So there's a few things we can think about in this section, which are very, very intriguing section. First of all, is why are they coming now? Like, what is going on here? Does it, first of all, does it sound like they're coming for war at the beginning? It says, look, it doesn't sound necessarily like that. They come as levakesh, like they're coming to ask him. So, what are they? But it does sound like there is war because Adam Melech is attacking them. So it sounds aggressive, but it sounds like they're asking, what is behind them? What's happening over here? Mefarshim really struggle with this. So one thing which we should bear in mind is David HaMelech has a complex relationship with Philistines. And that is because, on the one hand, they are the perennial enemy of everybody, of Shmuel, of Eli, of Shmuel, of Shaul HaMelech, of Ish-Boshesh. They're the perennial enemy of Israel. At the same, and David HaMelech fought them. But at the same time, David also camped among them. When David HaMelech was running from Shaul HaMelech, he found refuge among the Philistines. And so that's what the moment from the Forshim say. Take a look at this interesting Malbim on page 9. The Malbim says in 21, up till now, I thought he was an ally because he fought with Achish, the king of Gath, who was a Philistine. So they came to him with tax forms and they said, David, weren't you subservient to Achish? Well, now's the time. Now you've got bigger coffers. That means more taxes to us, right? So it wasn't they were necessarily coming to fight. They were actually coming because they believed that David HaMelech would carry on paying the taxes. Now they've got a man in the right spot. The Chiddush says a little slightly differently. Take a look at 22, interestingly enough. He says, starting from the unbolded words, that's the wrong Chiddush, actually. That's the same Chiddush we saw beforehand. And the one that's it's supposed to be over here is... Nope, I put it out over here, is that they were questioning, let me try to see if that, they actually, it wasn't that they were questioning his taxes, they thought that he betrayed them. Meaning, they felt, David HaMelech, you said you're going to fight with us, you came to us, we gave you a city, we protected you, everything was good, and now suddenly you're becoming the king of Israel, so they felt that this was an affront, they felt this was a betrayal, so they're actually coming with an aggressive stance, which is why David HaMelech attacks them. Fascinating. As opposed to Shaul, who is clearly at opposite ends of the spectrum with the Plishtim, David HaMelech is a more curious character to them because they don't know. He's been to them twice. Once he appeared mad, once in friendship. So this is why this relationship is starting off like this. Why do you think it is that when there's two attacks from the same place, from the same people, it's Emek Rephaim to Yerushalayim, and they're the same people, why is it Hashem in one case says attack from the front, and in one case Hashem says attack from the back? Why the difference? You just do the same thing. That's for simplicity's sake. Just attack them and finish them. What has changed? Jesse, what do you think?
Well, we've seen from Amalek that attacking from the front and attacking from the back are very qualitatively different views and approaches, right? Like the attacking someone from behind is really seen as almost like a cheap trick, whereas attacking someone from the front is like the more honorable fighting.
So what's happening then? So putting those packet facts into a story then.
Hashem is saying, I'm not going to make my protection of you so obvious.
Maybe that's what's going on over here. In fact, that's what the Ralbag, Rav Levi Ben Gershon, suggests, is going kind of in that direction, where he says it might be less honorable, but it's actually more practical. Meaning, when I'm attacking from the back, I have the element of surprise, which means to say that there's less godliness I need to protect me, so to speak, because Hashem's saying, you need to do a little more action. Obviously, Hashem's protecting us at all times, but Hashem has to be less overt, because it's not simply force against force, facing off on a battlefield, reloading their bows and arrows. Right? So what the Ralbag is suggesting over here, that David HaMelech is actually being taught a lesson in how to conduct military affairs, and that is that I'm going to start off, I'll make it easy for you, but afterwards you're going to have to do a little harder work. We see similar things early on. If you remember in Sefer Yehoshua, the first battle they have is against the city called Yericho, and in the city of Yericho they do very little. They walk around it seven times once a day. The seventh day they walk around seven times, blow the shofar, walls come down, and fantastic, all their defenses are gone. The second battle, not so simple. The second battle they walk into arrogantly, it's against a city called Ha'ai, and they actually lose the battle, the first battle. And one of the things that Hashem tells them what you need to do is you need to make an ambush around the back of the city, and then you're going to draw them out and run as if in retreat, and then raise the spear, and then the second party will attack from the rear. Why was that necessary? Because again, Hashem was demonstrating to Yahushua that it's all fun and nice in the desert where miracles happen every day. But now when you get into the land of Israel, I'm sort of weaning you off needing me overtly. You're going to see me in different ways. You're going to see me in a more hidden way. So what he's doing to David HaMelech as well, he's saying it's all been great, but understand that I'm trying to let you walk by yourself.
It kind of reminds me of contemporary history where the 67 war was an overt miracle. The 73 war being
much harder. Right, and it's interesting because sometimes the arrogance with which we enter into wars also, you know, so if we think that we are, you know, invincible, that's when sometimes we need a reminder that we need to do a little more work, you know, and we need to see Hashem even in the hiddenness. But yeah, awesome.
So I guess it's in line with it, but couldn't it be that Hashem wanted David to go out against the Philistines in face so that it asserts his authority as king and that they see he's the king and he's coming after them? And then when he comes again, it's more like, well, let's just get the job done.
That's interesting. So the first one's more of that, we'll call it the public presentation,
right?
The picture opportunity for the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And the second time is, oh, it's just, you know, they just don't learn their lesson. Just got to take care of them, right? So that might be the second opportunity. Very interesting. Very intriguing. Yeah. It's just interesting because you see in this parak, the parak is lining up the immediate events following David HaMelech's assuming kingship. And we're seeing in each of them something which is showing us something about David HaMelech's power and David HaMelech's policies even, which leads us to the next thing. I wanted to start a little bit of this next section, but this section obviously we're going to have to expand a little more because the time will require a little more. So let's go straight into Perek Vav, which is now, it relates to the Aron. So the next thing David HaMelech has done, he's now, the enemies are off the front, Yerushalayim is captured, right? He now has his palace has been donated by his friendly neighbor in the north. So David HaMelech is sort of settling down at this point in time. What does he do next? He realizes that the Aron needs a place. Just a little bit of background over here. The Aron at this point in time, the Ark, is to be found in a place called Kiryas Ye'arim. It is an area in central Israel. Why is it not in the Mishkan at this point in time? Just a little bit of historical point just before we get into this. Why is the Mishkan not in the Mishkan, pray tell? And the answer is it's not explicit in Tanakh, but it seems pretty obvious. Why? Well, the Mishkan has actually been destroyed, right? So again, Tanakh talks about this in innuendo, but it seems that the Mishkan has been destroyed at this point in time by the Philistines, no less. And in fact, the Aron was already taken into exile and was returned 7 months later. But since then, they never really made a new place for it. They had this place in Kiryat Yearim, but there was no Mishkan per se. So you can imagine the sort of the embarrassment of Hashem's Ark, of the Covenant, not really having its own place. And David HaMelech is rectifying that because now that we have a little bit of safety and security on the borders, we can start talking about spiritual, you know, this being the spiritual center of Judaism, which hasn't been up to now because Shaul has never really had that moment. He's always been fighting off, staving off the people on the borders. It's been a very difficult time. So now that with that flexibility, this is what we hear next. So let's focus just on the first five psukim. So in this perek, so it'll be Aleph to Hey, and it's very interesting what happens here. Vayosef od David el kol bachur bi Yisrael shloshim erev. David HaMelech takes 30,000 young men. Vayokom vayelech David v'chol ha'am asher yitzom ba'ale Yehuda la'alos misham es aron olekim asher nikro shem Hashem. Where they're going to now bring up the Aron, which was the name of God who's upon it. They bring it upon a new cart, a new wagon. And we have these people, the children of Avinadav. They're Uzza and his brothers, and are leading this wagon. And Achio is coming with it. V'David v'chol beis Yisrael mesachakim lifnei Hashem v'chol atzei berosim v'chinerois v'nevolois v'tupim v'menaneim v'tzalayim. So they are making merry. They're singing. They're dancing. They're making music in front of the Aaron. over here, it's interesting. Where are these 30,000 people coming from? Like that's not exactly That's not exactly an easy number of people to get to any event. So why are they here? How did he do this? So it could be what some of the Poshim suggest is he's moving straight off the conscription, meaning they just fought the Plishtim. Mm-hmm. So hey, we have a whole army camped here. So let's take the opportunity to take the conscripts and move them straight into the next episode. Okay, this is going to be, we're going to bring in the Federal Reserves. They're right here already. Let's use them to take the Aron in. I thought it was an interesting thing that there is a fascinating Kabbalistic note that the Chida once again says. The Chida is unbelievably phenomenal. Just one quick story about the Chida. I believe it's the Chida, just to appreciate his brilliance. So he says there was a time when in those days there was a fellow who's producing cheese, and the Chida was forced to, I don't know if it was the Chida who did this, or the Chida was the other side of the story. I'll tell you in a second. It was not, the Chida was the one who read this. There was a Rav who was asked to give a Hechsher on cheese, and the cheese was clearly not kosher. But the means of convincing involved threatening the Rav's family with death. So he felt compelled to give the Hechsher. Right, because in those days apparently the cheese mafia must have been very strong. This individual was threatening this Rav with death if his family with death should he not give the Hechsher on the cheese, right? And so what does he do? He wrote the Hechsher, which is a sort of a letter in those days to say that this particular product is kosher. And the end he says. And so you should eat it with your loins girded, meaning with excitement you should eat it. And he wrote afterwards, he wrote Shmos, which is where the pasuk comes from. And but instead of writing Shmos, like the book of Shmos, he wrote Shin Mem Vav apostrophe Taf, right? Which is really the name Shmot, but whenever you put an apostrophe in a word, it usually means?
It's an acronym.
So it's interesting. So the Chida receives this Hechsher, he looks at the Hechsher, and he sees this quotation, and this is a pasuk in Parashas Bo, which is in Sefer Shmos, so it makes sense. But he realizes that the apostrophe is excellent, extra, and actually the Shmos is actually an acronym for what? Is anybody familiar? This is just an interesting fact. Shmos is an acronym for Shnaim Mikra V'Echad Targum. There's a halacha that people are supposed to learn the parasha twice over in the text and once with an Aramaic translation every week. And this is actually brought in Shulchan Aruch, and that's what we do. So he realized that the person writing the Hechsher was trying to tell him to look in the Targum. So he looked in the Targum, and this is in Perek Yud Beis in Sefer Shmos, and it says, on that pasuk, it means like your belt's girded, meaning like with excitement. That's talking about the matzahs you leave Egypt. So he looked at it and it translated as follow: Kacha tachlun yasun, mosnechem isrin. Isrin means tied, but it also means asur, which means it's forbidden. So the Chida immediately understood the code and had the fellow arrested and was able to say this. So there's phenomenal stories about the Chida, very very interesting individual on many levels. And so he says over here, take a look what the Chida says in this section. I think I'll just close this because I don't want to jump into the Uzzah section just right now. But here's what he says. The Chida says, let me just see what number source this is. We've been doing a lot of Chida today. It's 24. The Chida says, Vayasef David es el kol bachor b'Yisrael 30,000. Efshar is possible. Sheba mispar zeh remez l'shem ha-miyuchad im arbo osiyos. Shu mispar 30. Why did he choose 30,000 men? So it wasn't just because that's how many people were in the tents. It is because it's the name of Hashem. How does that work? What do you think that means? It's the name, the numbers of the name of Hashem. Just if you want to do the actual math, you're looking at the name of Hashem, the Shem Avaya, which is Yud Hey and then a Vav and a Hey. If you do the actual, if you do the gematria of that is Yud is 10, Hey is 5, so 15. Then Vav is another 6, so that's 21, and a Hey is 26. So the name of Hashem, famously, is 26. That's the Gematria Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. But how many letters are there? There's four letters. We need to say that the Torah is conveying to you not just simply a sound, not just simply a concept, but it's also conveying to you a number. There's numerous channels that the Torah communicates to us on. So the number it's communicating to us as well is 26/30. So he says maybe what he's doing is he's using a number which expresses HaKadosh Baruch Hu's fullness in this world in a mass scale. Then he goes on further and he says, interesting enough, "Keneged Hamalchus Shenikra B'Shloishim Hamalos Kemispar Yehuda." Fascinating. He says, well, who also is the person who has Malchus, who has kingship, is the tribe of Yehuda. Take the Gematria. Yehuda, notice, is interestingly enough, it is like the Shem Havaya. It's like the name of Yud-Kei and then a Vav-Kei, but it has a Dalet in it, which brings it up to 30. So what essentially David HaMelech is doing over here is not simply just gathering all the people in the playground. What he's doing is he's saying this is a moment where Hashem, who, so to speak, has been absent explicitly from our society, needs to be reintroduced. We need to pull Aaron back to the place where it's supposed to live. We need to bring Hashem back through what? What mechanism? Through Malchus, which is Yehuda, which is represented through himself. So the Chidah is just saying, just like, you know, just numerous levels of coding. When we're looking at this, we're reading a story, it's an interesting narrative, but there's also more going on Kabbalistically. What I don't want to spend too much time on that, because there's just, I don't want to get lost in it right now, is we're going to see now that a tragedy occurs, because one of the carriers of this on this cart over here reaches out for the Aaron and dies because of reaching out for the Aaron. We're going to unpack that because it's actually a very complicated episode that happens next. And what was wrong, because it seems like it's so positive, what was negative in this? God willing, that'll be in 2 weeks' time. Next week, Mr. Shem, we will do Chanukah. So we'll be back here, God willing, 8 o'clock on Wednesday night. We'll be learning Chanukah.